Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in October, and we'll send you a limited edition Here I Stand t-shirt. Find out more about our monthly or annual giving program at issuesetc.org. Just click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses, or call Craig 618-223-8385. Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by Reformation Day, and we'll send you a limited edition long sleeve shirt along with your other membership benefits. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club. You wouldn't initially think that the history classroom, be it European history or American history 101, would be a place where Christians would find challenges to the Christian worldview, but turns out it actually is. What kind of challenges might that be? Coming off the long weekend of the Columbus Day celebration, you might have heard one of them about Christopher Columbus himself, that rather than a Christian explorer who was out to find a way to expand the trade of Western Europe, he was, in fact, a plunderer, an oppressor, an imperialist, and brought nothing good to the people that he visited when he did his explorations. That might have been something you just heard a couple days ago. You might hear it in the history classroom as well. Welcome back to Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon, October the 13th. It's part four of our series, Classroom Apologetics Today, European and American History 101. Joining us for our series, Dr. Mark Kaltoff. He's professor and chairman of the Department of History at Hillsdale College. Mark, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Glad to be here.
After week one or so, the students sitting there in European or American History 101, are there going to be warning flags already that the professor is teaching history from a secular progressive perspective?
Well, if they're in a college classroom, the chances are he probably is. And that's because so many colleges and universities today, especially the larger ones, have taken hold of a certain perspective that's been informed by a generation of what one scholar, Roger Kimball, a few years ago called in his book titled Tenured Radicals, that the largely in many college and university history departments are populated by faculty members who were taught by or came of age in the wake of the Cultural Revolutions of the 60s and 70s, in which the prevailing ideologies shaped the way the historical profession was undertaken. And there are those who get their credentials, earn their PhDs in graduate programs, and manage not to drink too deeply at the well of gender, race, and class as the defining archetypes. But those are the three words that you'll often find, and that might be one of the first signals if the professor says what we need to understand is that history is about understanding disfranchised minorities, the common people, gender, race, and class are the primary filters. Maybe it's important to see that one of the most important books that's informed the teaching, for example, of American history is Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States from 1492 to the present. It was published in 1980. And originally only 4,000 copies were produced, but today it's sold over 2.2 million. And if you listen to what Zinn had to say, he said he wasn't so much interested in studying the past to learn about the past or studying the past to learn about facts. He was interested in the present, and he was interested in seeing how the past could be useful to change the world today. So if a student encounters a professor who's interested in changing the world and is interested in the categories of our sociological discourse today, be they gender, race, and class, or LGBT issues, and those issues are going to be the defining frameworks for looking at the past, probably there's a progressive agenda at work.
I wanted to ask you at the outset about historicism, this general view that history has meaning, that maybe it even has a purpose or a purpose toward which it drives. Is that something that the Christian student of history should accept or reject? What cautions would you have there?
Well, I would offer a number of cautions. First of all, history is messy. It's made up of all kinds of complicated stories of people making decisions that have implications for the future that they don't have in mind, unintended consequences. There's repeatedly the messiness of people acting in ways that are going to influence their neighbors, their fellows, in decisions both momentous and mundane that we can't anticipate. So I'm suspicious of meta-narratives that historians try to impose upon the past and suggest that it all can be boiled down to this one simple theme. The things that Christians believe about the past, I mean, Christianity being a historical religion, we are concerned about knowing the past, about certain important space-time events, the death and resurrection of Christ being right there. But Christians also understand the meaning of history, not because some historians have told us that, but because we have revealed scripture that gives us a kind of perspective on the messiness of history that helps make sense of it. But then we're not doing history as much as we're doing theology, perhaps, when that comes along. This doesn't mean that history is meaningless, though. It seems to me that there are lessons that we can learn. The more things change, the speed at which the world changes, we're continually dealing with this flux, and there's a tendency of people, especially the younger generation, to say, well, everything's new, what was happened yesterday doesn't matter anymore. And it seems to me that the more things change, the more we need to have a fix and a hold on those truths that are timeless and changeless so that we can set those against the present. I'm reminded of that little essay C.S. Lewis wrote called Learning in Wartime, in which he was defending the study of poetry during World War II, but he also was defending the study of history, and he said, we need something to set against the present. In the same way, he said that the person who has traveled to different places is not deceived by the local errors of his native village. The person who has studied the past is less likely to be deceived by the cacophony of noise that and falsehoods that pour from the press and microphone of his own age. And so there are truths that are timeless that historians can see. This doesn't mean that history is just repeats itself, but I like to say to my students, sometimes it rhymes. In other words, sometimes there are ways in which we can discern truths about what it means to be a human being and what flourishing as humans looks like by studying different times and places.
So the task of history, is it simple enough to say the study of the past?
Well, I think it might be. I mean, the historian does want to understand the past, wants to understand what happened before now. The motivations for doing so might be rich and diverse. There might be simply a kind of antiquarian curiosity about what happened before I was born. But it's also the case that we were born into a world with lots of things, be they technologies or concepts, concepts like freedom and liberty and equality. These are concepts not of our own making, and they're ideas that people gave their lives for, pledged their sacred honor for, to keep and bequeath to us. So I think there's also a reason that we should want to know what happened before we were born so we can have a more robust existence in the present. Cicero once said, he who doesn't know what happened before he is born is destined to remain forever a child. And I think there's something about maturing and growing up to see where we fit in the scheme of things, and that's to know what happened before we were born.
It's part four of our series, Classroom Apologetics Today, European and American History 101. Dr. Mark Kaltoff is our guest, professor and chairman of the Department of History at Hillsdale College. We'll get into one of the first things you meet when you walk into European History 101. Right after this.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's our series, Classroom Apologetics. We are in the European and American History classrooms. Dr. Mark Kaltoff, he's professor and chairman of the Department of History at Hillsdale College. What we're doing here is very important, preparing the minds of young people to enter the high school and college classroom and to meet and to respond to and to be able to properly evaluate the challenges that they find there to the Christian mind, so to speak. But those students also need a connection to the more vital resources than their mind, and that is to a faithful pastor, faithful congregation, faithful Lutheran resources. That is the job of LCMSU. You can find out more about LCMSU at lcms.org/LCMSU. That's lcms.org/LCMSU. Dr. Koltoff, let's go into the European history classroom first. We'll get to American history a little bit later. And you say that one of the first challenges that will be met there is the very idea, the basic idea of the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages. What does that mean?
Right. Well, first of all, the very idea that we would call a period the Middle Ages is rather a tendentious idea. It was created by certain Renaissance thinkers who were so enamored by what they had discovered in ancient texts that they came to believe that somehow they were stumbling upon something better than what had come in the generations of their parents and grandparents. And so now that they had in their hands something other than the writings of Aristotle and a few of Plato's dialogues, they began to celebrate that there was this new light, a new birth of learning, the so-called Renaissance. And it's certainly true that there were new texts that became available in that early modern period, but the fact that new texts were being made available really is dismissive of the robust intellectual life that took place in the centuries before the Renaissance. The university itself was a creation of the Middle Ages. The seven liberal arts were alive in the Middle Ages. Almost everything that we have of the ancient world is a product of being preserved by Christian monasticism through the Middle Ages. So there's something already problematic about the kind of periodization that would suggest that there's the height of the classical world and the wonderful rebirth of classical ideas, and then this other area that's so dull, we just call it the middle period. The fact that some call it the Dark Ages suggests that middle period was characterized by foolish ignorance, such that people, for example, only believed that the earth was flat, something which is, you know, ridiculously silly. That's a myth that was itself invented and perpetuated in the 19th century, much later. To our knowledge, there are probably two human beings from the medieval period, really late antiquity, who defended the idea of a flat earth, and they were largely set aside. And so the idea of Christopher Columbus sailing and falling off the edge of a flat earth was a silly notion. I could say a lot more about that, but maybe you want to talk about something else.
Well, I want you to deal with that term Dark Ages, too, because it has a kind of historical chauvinism embedded in it, doesn't it?
No, it certainly does. I keep going back to my own training when I studied medieval intellectual history in graduate school for part of my time, and one of my mentors had written a book entitled God and Reason in the Middle Ages, and he did a masterful job at essentially demolishing any kind of myth that suggests the Middle Ages were ignorant, superstitious, and irrational. There have been ignorant, superstitious, and irrational people, I suppose, in every age, but that I wouldn't say that would be a fair way to characterize the Middle Ages. There was robust learning. Again, I mentioned the universities were founded. The idea of taking a place to set aside for scholarship, for reading, for teaching, for furthering ideas is a creation of the Christian West. So there are universities around the world. Those universities owe, in some respects, their origin to what happened in medieval Christendom, a place where learning was deeply cherished.
What about the so-called 1,000 years without a bath? It's an evocative image. But what is it intended to evoke about that time?
Well, I suspect it conjures an image not unlike something you might see in a Monty Python skit of people, you know, mudslinging peasants doing nothing other than wallowing in their dirt farm on the manor. But that doesn't capture the reality of what really was happening. It's to be true. Following the decline and fall, if you want to use those terms, of the Roman Empire in the late 5th century AD, civilization was struggling. That struggling civilization was due to difficulties having to do with unrestricted immigration, what's sometimes called barbarian invasions, and a general cultural decline. So there was a sense in which things slowed down a bit. But if we're interested in looking for something that I don't think historians should do, but too often do, and that is looking for villains and victims. Certainly the Christian church shouldn't be held as a source of this darkness. It was the place, it was the source of what cultural light there could have been. When a civilization is in some kind of crisis, it's probably the case that there aren't going to be a lot of patrons for learning. The patronage necessary for the leisure that makes learning possible requires a level of cultural stability, coherence, and surplus wealth. And when a civilization is in its own way struggling with preserving political order, it's not surprising that you don't have a National Science Foundation there to provide independent research. But as a patron of sciences and the arts, certainly the Christian church was better than any other institution, political, secular, that anyone can point to throughout that 1,000 years.
Speaking of the church, another myth that you cite that I've heard repeated ad nauseum is that Galileo, famous astronomer and philosopher, was imprisoned or somehow tortured by the church for advocating Copernicanism, that model of the universe that was relatively new at his time, firmly establishing the church as the eternal enemy of science. Take that
right.
one apart.
Well, the Galileo affair has been, and until recent generations, and professional historians of science today have come to a much, much better understanding of Galileo than you might have found 50 or 100 years ago. But the story is, I'm paraphrasing, often told that Galileo was some kind of champion of free thought and some kind of point man for the scientific community who turns his telescope to the heaven and sees irrefutable evidence somehow that proves that the Earth moves and that the sun stands still, and that the church, ruffled by this for fear that it contradicts their cherished understanding of Scripture, does all it can to silence him, including threatening him with jail or torture, or in fact putting him in jail and torturing him. And the truth really couldn't be further from this. First of all, Galileo thought he had this positive evidence of the Earth's motion and the proof of the Copernican hypothesis, but his evidence was faulty. He grounded most of his confidence in a theory he had about the tides. And although he thought it was a good theory, it turns out that it really wasn't a good theory. He did have interesting telescopic observations, but the telescopic observations themselves stopped short of demonstrating that the Earth moved. They certainly showed problems with the one of the leading competitive theories, that of Claudius Ptolemy, the second century astronomer. But Galileo overstated his case, and he did so in a context where he was alienating himself not so much from the church as from the leading natural philosophers, as we would call scientists in those days. Many of them had independent arguments with Galileo over the behavior of falling bodies, the floating bodies in water, sunspots, how to interpret a supernova. And in case after case, Galileo was at odds with many of these leaders of the scientific community. And when they found themselves frustrated by his virtuosity and these other arguments, they began to involve the church in challenging his robust claim to the motion of the Earth. Leaders of the church were certainly open to the prospect that the Earth might move, but they wanted to see good evidence. One of the most important leading figures, Cardinal Robert Bellarmine, was pretty clear. He said, you know, if there's a true demonstration that the sun is at the center of the world, I'd like to see that demonstration, but I can't believe that there's such a demonstration until someone shows it to me. And he was not persuaded by anything Galileo had to show him about the tides. So Galileo kind of dug himself into a hole, and he did so even further when he was enjoined not to teach or publicly discuss this idea of the Earth's motion. And instead, he went ahead and wrote his dialogue on the two chief world systems, which he published in 1632, and it was a dialogue between generally three figures, and into the mouth of the fool, he put the words of the Pope. And so when it was pointed out to the Pope that Galileo was actually using this opportunity to what appeared to be ridiculing the Pope, Galileo was summoned to Rome and put on trial. Ultimately, he was found vehemently suspected of heresy. In other words, he was never officially charged as a heretic, but he was placed under house arrest in his comfortable Italian villa for the remainder of his days, in which he continued his scientific work. So the story is much more interesting than the narrow one that makes it look like the church was anti-intellectual and bigoted.
And just the point there that I think needs to be brought forward is that while he did have his opponents in his theory about the motion of heavenly bodies and the place of the sun and the earth, mm-hmm. those opponents were largely within the natural science community and not in the church itself.
Absolutely. And the other thing, though, to keep in mind is that every human being involved in this was a confessing Christian, and for the most part, at least in terms of the trial of Galileo, they were all Roman Catholics. You had different interests. You had a Jesuit faction, and you had some Dominicans, and you had Galileo, a layman, and that was part of the problem that got him in hot water. Here we are in the aftermath of the Council of Trent, when the Roman Catholic Church has kind of taken more of a conservative turn, always afraid of laymen and people apart from the church hierarchy interpreting the Bible on their own. We know what Luther had done with that, right? And here was Galileo, the layman, presuming to give the sense of how to read Scripture in light of Copernicanism. And this was just too dangerous a territory to go to. But there wasn't any faction between, say, sacred and secular in the Galileo affair, because there wasn't anyone who was claiming in that affair to be outside the church.
We'll talk more about the so-called scientific revolution and its, well, triumph over religion, reason over religion, those claims made in the European History 101 classroom with Dr. Mark Kalthoff right after this. I'm Todd Wilkin. Issues, etc. continues on the other side of the break.
Are you a homeschool parent looking for help teaching certain subjects? Or do you want your student to study the history, languages, and literature of Western civilization? Memoria Press Online Academy has live online classes with master teachers to help you. Their teachers have years of experience teaching, delighting, and moving students literally from all around the world. Your homeschool year doesn't have to be difficult. Visit MemoriaPressAcademy.com or call 877-745-8866.
Do you dread going to work out?
Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at PerformanceFitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or PerformanceFitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Epiphany Lutheran Church in Door, Michigan gathers to receive our Lord's gifts in word, baptism, and supper every Sunday morning at 9:15. Bible study at 11. Join us at 4219 Park Lane in Door, or visit us on the web, epiphanydoor.org. Christ-centered, cross-focused, historic, confessional, liturgical, Epiphany Lutheran Church in Door, Michigan. EpiphanyDoor.org, 616-681-0791.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Thursday afternoon, October the 13th, we're continuing our series, Classroom Apologetics. Today, we're in European History 101 and a little bit later, American History 101 classrooms. Dr. Mark Kalthoff is our guest, professor and chairman of the Department of History at Hillsdale College. Dr. Kalthoff, what about the idea that the scientific revolution, in essence, liberated the mind from the shackles of religion, the triumph of reason over religion?
Right. Well, one of the most fascinating things about the scientific revolution is that when you look at the luminaries of the events of the late 16th, but mostly the 17th century, you come up with names of people like Galileo, Isaac Newton, Robert Boyle, René Descartes. The list goes on of these Johannes Kepler. These are names that most even school children bump into when they study an outline of Western European intellectual history of science. These are all people who were deeply committed Christians. If it's the case that the scientific revolution meant reason letting go of religion, it would be odd to set that up in such a way when many of the leaders themselves saw themselves as doing God's work. Take, for example, Kepler, who was himself a Lutheran. He originally thought that he would be a Lutheran minister. He went to seminary and ended up instead going in the route of mathematics and astronomy. And he was thrilled later in his life when he saw, when he came up with his laws of planetary motion, that his work was being useful. He said, "I originally thought that I would become a preacher, but seeing that I'm able to glorify God and do God's work this way, I'm happy to see myself as effectively reading the book of nature." One of the prevailing metaphors was the metaphor of God's two books, that he reveals himself through his words and through his works. And many of the scientists of the scientific revolution saw themselves as exegetes of nature, that they were reading the handiwork of God and laying it bare as they were seeking to recover the lost knowledge that Adam had once had. Isaac Newton, he actually wrote more on theology than he did on science. If you would take a pile and stack up all his theological musings, and he was particularly interested in Old Testament prophecy, he wrote more about theology and speculated upon the divine and his natural philosophy than he did in his comparatively briefer scientific works. Robert Boyle, one of the leaders of modern founding of modern chemistry, was very much concerned to do his science as an exercise in natural theology, showing that God was a designer who had revealed his own power, wisdom, and attributes in his book of nature.
Let's turn to the issue of American history, not disconnected entirely from European history, but the first one, and it is a little timely, having come off this week from the celebration of so-called Columbus Day here in the United States. Columbus has been turned into a villain, hasn't he?
It's been very fashionable. Ever about the time of the 500th anniversary back in 1992, he was rather than celebrated as this hero who was, as his name means, Christ-bearer, bringing the Christian faith to the world, was instead some kind of rank imperialist who was doing all he could to essentially rape and pillage, spread disease, and enslave people. And that's much of what you hear. And the Columbus Wars, as some like to call them, have continued. In fact, I just happened to notice this past Monday, Columbus Day, there was a fairly lengthy editorial in the Wall Street Journal calling for straight talk about Christopher Columbus. And the author of that piece was generally right in pushing back on a typical generalization. I'm actually just arrived in the mail this week. I'm reviewing a textbook that is a brand new book out, just a standard American history textbook. And after in the section on Columbus, I just happened to open it up earlier today just to see what they said. The author says that after Columbus came in and began to subjugate some of the people there in the island of Hispaniola and San Salvador, he writes, "Thus began the typical European bias displayed toward the Indians, destroy or enslave them." And the thing that's interesting about that is Columbus is turned into a whipping boy to be anti-Western, anti-European. But the fact of the matter is that in the late 15th and early 16th century, the world wasn't a particularly tolerant or friendly place measured by many of the standards that we have come to appreciate today. Europeans themselves were looking to the West to travel across the Atlantic to get to the East because they couldn't go the short way, which was to turn back and go east, because there were all these Muslims and Moors who were in their way. And what it turned out is that wherever you went, the stronger people of the world were causing the weaker people to suffer. And so about Columbus's time, the Muslims and the Chinese were much more powerful than the poor Europeans. And the result of that is that the Europeans were suffering themselves. They were being enslaved. Millions died from plagues that were brought to them from further east. The world of the 16th and 17th century, or 15th and 16th century, was a world in which it was normal for powerful people to subjugate weaker people. We didn't have modern medicine, so diseases killed people. Slavery was rampant the world over. The exceptional thing about Columbus isn't that he did those things. He did some of those things, and so did everyone else. The more exceptional thing was that over time, the ideas that he spread and that those who followed in his wake, that Christendom in Western Europe was the home of the place that gradually exterminated slavery, gradually began to share ideas about free trade, gradually began to express an idea of tolerance. This idea of tolerance and being willing not just to say might makes right is itself a Western idea that grew out of the civilization that was Columbus's. So he was in some respects a product of his time, but that doesn't make him the one to demonize as much as for the historian to say, well, let's come and understand the late 15th and early 16th century and see if the European practices as they traveled to North America were particularly different than the way the Europeans were being treated by, say, Muslims or Chinese or others who might encounter them.
That kind of raises again in our conversation a general principle, and that is the historian, either the professor or the student historian, cannot simply say, here are my 21st century mores, values, and sensibilities. Now I'm going to go and impose them on the figures of history.
That's exactly right. And this is one of the greatest temptations for students of history and one of the biggest responsibilities for good professors is to recognize we all are living now and we have concerns of our day and of our age. Many of them are legitimate and understandable, but the job of the historian and the honest student of history is not to take those high-minded views that we've come to accept as normative in our day and sniff around in the past to find who either succeeded or failed to live up to our standards of what is normative excellence, but instead to understand the past and understand what circumstances, ideas, events, people made it possible for people to hold as given ideas that seem foreign to us. Sometimes ideas that seem foreign to us were very high and noble ones that we've forgotten to cling to and we need to relearn. And in other cases, we have overcome obstacles that tripped up previous generations. But rather than standing in judgment of the past, and I very much don't like the phrase arc of history, as if there's this kind of necessary progress that because we're alive today, we are better than those who came before, and therefore we are entitled to judge them. I think it was C.S. Lewis who called that outlook chronological snobbery, the idea that somehow those who are further down the timeline are, by virtue of that progress, necessarily more enlightened. It would seem to me that notion, also sometimes has been called presentism, doesn't do much help because it assumes that whatever we're doing now, by virtue of the fact that we're doing it now, is better than what we did before, and it can become a self-justifying move for bad policy and a kind of presentist hubris that we should want to avoid.
Dr. Mark Kaltoff is our guest professor and chairman of the Department of History at Hillsdale College. It's our series, Classroom Apologetics, and today we're in the European and American History Classrooms 101. When we come back, we'll talk about the Puritans.
We would like to overlook the difficulty of daily repentance and death to our sins in the interest of progressing to a more advanced spirituality.
Rebecca Curtis from her new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Somehow, spiritual advancement always amounts to our getting to spend more time on the things we like and calling it stewardship or service.
You can purchase and download an audio version of Ladylike, Living Biblically at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Ladylike, Living Biblically by Rebecca Curtis and Rose Adel.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. Issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Are you looking for Christmas cards that combine beautiful art with a clear Christian confession? Emmanuel Press offers Christ-centered, affordable cards in a variety of designs. You'll find cards with stained glass, illumination, German frescoes, and other unique artwork found only at Emmanuel Press. Visit their website, emmanuelpress.us, emmanuelpress.us.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation approaches. A good time to ask, who are we as confessional Lutherans? What's our heritage? The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission has produced the Layman's Guide to Theological History. Go to the CLCC.org and see which of these presentations and books would be most helpful to you and your fellow parishioners. And consider becoming a member with us as the CLCC seeks to help more people know what it means to be a confessional Lutheran. The CLCC.org.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. Mount Zion Lutheran, Greenfield, Wisconsin, Pilgrim Lutheran, West Bend, Wisconsin, Messiah Lutheran, Lebanon, Illinois, Zion Lutheran, Accident, Maryland, Redeemer Lutheran, Jackson, Wyoming, Messiah Lutheran, Marysville, Washington, Trinity Lutheran, Millstadt, Illinois, Our Savior Lutheran, Houston, Texas, St. Matthew's Lutheran, Bon Terre, Missouri, Good Shepherd Lutheran, Lincoln, Nebraska, Hope Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri, Trinity Lutheran, Austin, Texas, Good Shepherd Lutheran, Collinsville, Illinois, Luther Memorial Chapel, Shorewood, Wisconsin, Christ Lutheran, Oak Park, Illinois, Bethany Lutheran, Naperville, Illinois, and Emmanuel Lutheran, Dearborn, Michigan. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support. The Issues, Etc. 300.
We are in the European and American History Classrooms with Dr. Mark Kaltoff, part of our series Classroom Apologetics, dealing with some challenges that students will often hear in those classrooms and under those subjects. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Dr. Mark Kaltoff is professor and chairman of the Department of History at Hillsdale College. Folks, if you're enjoying our series, Classroom Apologetics, please help us educate a new generation of Lutherans by joining the Issues, Etc. Reformation Club. It's our monthly or annual giving program. Membership benefits include the I Have Issues short sleeve t-shirt, books, broadcast transcripts, and advertising for your confessional Lutheran church. And if you join by Reformation Day, the 31st of October, we'll also send you a limited edition Here I Stand long sleeve t-shirt. You can find out more and join by clicking the picture of Martin Luther, posting the 95 Theses at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or join by check. Make your check payable to Issues, Etc. Send it to Issues, Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. That's Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. The Issues, Etc. Reformation Club. Dr. Kaltoff, what's the biggest myth about the, well, some of the biggest players in early American history, the Puritans?
Oh, the Puritans. Well, of course, we like to have this picture of these dour-looking people with black clothes and big buckles on their shoes and hats. H.L. Mencken, the great American journalist, once quipped something like, I think, that Puritanism is the haunting suspicion that someone somewhere is having a good time. And, of course, he couldn't be further from the truth. The Puritans were serious people. But they also had a good time. They enjoyed their rum. They dressed in bright colors. And they weren't sort of held up as the proto-fundamentalists who were Bible thumpers without a serious thought in their head. If we look at, for example, Massachusetts Bay Colony, they established their first college, which, by the way, was Harvard, only 6 years after landing in Massachusetts Bay. They said, we got to have a place to teach our young people. And among those early arrivals to Massachusetts Bay, there were over 100 graduates of Oxford and Cambridge. One scholar has suggested that probably Puritan Massachusetts Bay Colony, if you look at the proportion of people living there, was the best educated community that the world has ever known, either before or since, in terms of proportion of people with Oxbridge degrees and high-minded intellectual achievement. They stayed up with the day's best science, the day's political developments. They were thoughtful people as well.
And in a very real sense, their understanding of community, and I'm speaking here kind of in general terms, was deeply formative of the American idea of itself, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the Harvard historian Edmund Morgan, probably 30, 40 years ago, came out with a little book that I still commend to students today who are interested in the subject called The Puritan Family. And he wasn't writing a book that was about the Puritan view of the family because it was a sidelight that he was interested in. Somebody else could have written a book on Puritan sports or Puritan agriculture. But his argument was that the Puritans understood the family as the central institution. As the family goes, so goes the society. They had prohibitions against stray bachelors or maidens living not under the cover and household of a male head of the family. They believed in a kind of traditional but extended family structure because they saw the family as the seedbed of society, as the first school, the first church, and that the order of society flowed from a loving, ordered, properly constituted family that saw itself as fulfilling God's understanding of society. So they were very intentional about that.
What is the picture typically painted in the American History 101 class of the American founders?
The American founders. Well, the interesting thing about that term is that the founders themselves were not monolithic. They had different views. If you would ask the various founders, for example, what they thought of Plato or Aristotle or certain classical authors, they would have reasons to disagree among one another. And so if you treat them as the founders, then one thing that you can do is you can pick the founder who is guilty of the sin that you want to convict someone of and then tar them all with that. And if there's something that you like about one of the founders, you can spread it around and say they all have that. So you could look at somebody like Thomas Jefferson, who was suspicious of divine revelation, was rather deistic in his leanings, was known for his Jefferson Bible that excised the miracles of Christ from it. And you could say, and look, this guy was one of the principal draftsmen of the Declaration of Independence, so he's an important and representative founder. Therefore, the founders were mostly deists who believed in a clockmaker God that didn't engage in the world. He wasn't the kind of God you would pray to in expectation of an answer to your prayers. Of course, to say that about all the founders would be far from the truth, because many of them were serious in their Christian faith and deeply knowledgeable in the Bible, and that informed the way that they thought and saw the world. Some of the founders, not all of them, but some of them owned slaves. And those who owned slaves treated them differently. And some made arrangements for their slaves to be freed upon their death. Some realized that they were in a tough situation and didn't know quite how to handle it. Jefferson himself once said, the institution of slavery, it's like having a wolf by the ears. You can neither safely hold it nor let it go. It was a conundrum that they had, but many textbooks point out the fact that because founders owned slaves, they couldn't be but hypocrites because they wrote a declaration that declared all men were created equal. And how could that possibly be if they owned slaves? So there are a number of these kinds of contentions that they were either all enlightened or they were all hypocrites. And the careful studying of the American founding reveals a more nuanced picture, I think.
They also didn't know they were going to be founders. They were landed gentlemen. They were representatives of their various colonies, certainly no doubt about that. But they didn't know that they were going to turn out to be the icons of the American Revolution. They brought their slaves with them as landed gentlemen, as practically every landed gentleman did there, to cut them a little slack. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's largely fair, I would say. They didn't know that they were founders in the sense that many of them did not think of themselves as revolutionaries. It was, you know, late. It was 1776 before they began to start making noises that were very meaningful about independence from Great Britain. And this was a constitutional crisis that had begun at the end of the French and Indian War and had raged on since before the Stamp Act of 1765. So we're looking at about a decade, decade and a half period after the French and Indian War, during which British policy to North America had changed. And the thing that you heard again and again in the writings and state papers from the men who would become founders was that they were claiming that their rights as freeborn British subjects were not being upheld according to the standards of the British Constitution. So they were falling all over themselves for a long time to preserve their connections with Great Britain, to demonstrate their loyalty to Great Britain and to the Crown, and to show that the Parliament wasn't treating them properly. It's not really the language of somebody who's positioning themselves to go down in history as founders of a new nation. It was only when they realized that the cup of forbearance had been completely emptied that they were now put in a position where they had to pledge their lives and fortunes and sacred honor, as the Declaration says. And it was after doing that they realized that they were doing something monumental, and they were also aware that the stakes were high and that they might fail and go down as a laughingstock.
On that phrase, all men are created equal, many of them did, most of them did understand, whether they were Orthodox Christians or not, that was a phrase borrowed lock, stock, and barrel from a Christian worldview, didn't they?
Yeah, well, it's interesting the way that term has been parsed many, many different ways. And I kind of like looking at the Declaration of Independence very quickly, within a generation, gets almost elevated to the status of American scripture. And as you know, they're with text, if you torture them enough, you can get them to confess almost anything. And it's a fascinating exercise to look at the way the Declaration has been used over the course of time, some ways far more persuasively than others. At the 150th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, one of my favorite presidents, and this shows my own quirkiness, I guess, is Calvin Coolidge. And he gave a speech called The Inspiration of the Declaration. And one of the things that he sought to point out was two of the big themes in the Declaration, the idea of the equality of people and that governments are legitimate by the consent of their governed. He went back to colonial American sermons, and he found preachers who were expositing these ideas. And Coolidge's own conclusion was that these are spiritual ideas that flow from a theological source, and they're not merely rationalistic enlightenment ideas. They're not contrary to reason rightly ordered, but Coolidge's argument was that these are very much spiritual ideals.
What is the myth of the American robber baron, industrial capitalist?
Well, there was a book that was published in the 1930s by a historian named Matthew Josephson. And the book has sort of become the definitive first-time statement. And the title of his book is The Robber Barons, The Great American Capitalists from 1861 to 1900. And his book is attempting to provide what he calls a history of a small class of men. And he called these people, by various names, barons, kings, empire builders. And his job was to characterize them as aggressive men who were like the feudal barons of old, except they created the modern industrial world, but they still behaved in ways that were lawless. And he tries to underscore that nearly all of them acted without established moral principles that would be fixed in the conduct of most common people. So the picture was that the industrial capitalists were shifty in their morals, perhaps hardworking and risk-taking, but they made the most they could by taking government subsidies, bilking the public whenever they could, and lining their wallets as deeply as they could. And this, of course, theme from Josephson is also picked up by others, most notably by Howard Zinn, who was in his People's History that I mentioned earlier, is vigorous in going after these industrialists and telling them that they are explaining, he complains, that they are just beneficiaries of the welfare state because they used government subsidies and such to help themselves out, and that they couldn't stand competition at all, and that they secured for themselves government-assisted monopolies. That's the so-called robber baron story. It has been challenged. In fact, one of my colleagues here at Hillsdale wrote a book a number of years ago called The Myth of the Robber Barons, and he looks at the rise of big business in America, and he points out that it's true some of these robber barons accepted government subsidies, and they tended to be these kind of entrepreneurs that he calls political entrepreneurs. But if you look more closely at people like James J. Hill, who helped found the Transcontinental Railway, or the steamship industry under Vanderbilt, especially John D. Rockefeller in the oil industry, these men took risks and they welcomed competition, and the competition was wide, and they became wealthy by providing a better product at a lower price on a free market. And then the other thing that they tended to do is after they made millions, they tended to give their money away. By the time John D. Rockefeller hit his 80th year, he gave away in that year alone $138 million, and over the course of his lifetime gave away over $500 million, more than anybody had ever given away before. So these men were tended to be generous, and Andrew Carnegie himself wrote a work called The Gospel of Wealth, in which he said, for those who have the ability to make money, that should only be the first half of their career. The second half of their career should be devoted to philanthropically distributing it in ways that will benefit their world.
Dr. Mark Kaltoff is our guest, professor and chairman of the Department of History at Hillsdale College. Part four of our series, Classroom Apologetics, today, European and American History 101. We'll talk about the Scopes Trial on the other side of the break.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death, and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club in October, and we'll send you a limited edition Here I Stand t-shirt. Find out more about our monthly or annual giving program at issuesetc.org. Just click the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses, or call Craig 618-223-8385. Join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by Reformation Day, and we'll send you a limited edition long sleeve shirt along with your other membership benefits. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
The sharpest arrow in your apologetics quiver. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Trinity Orchard Farm is settled between two rivers, showing the way to the water of life. For worship that is reverent, relevant, and refreshing like pure water, or for excellent education in a unique setting, check out our church and school. We're just 5 miles north of Highway 370 on Highway 94 in St. Charles County. Visit us on the web at trinityorchardfarm.com. That's trinityorchardfarm.com. Our phone number is 636-250-3350.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. It's our series, Classroom Apologetics. We're in the European and American History classrooms. Dr. Mark Kaltoff, professor and chairman of the Department of History at Hillsdale College, is our guest. Let's talk a little bit about a significant moment that's often misrepresented in the American history classroom, the Scopes trial. It's usually represented as a sound and permanent victory of evolutionary reason over fundamentalism. Tell us the real story, Dr. Kaltoff.
So the Scopes trial took place in the 10 days of a hot July summer of 1925, and it was the story, it was kind of a setup trial. John Thomas Scopes was the local general science teacher and football coach at Dayton, Tennessee. And the reason that he was on trial was because the Tennessee legislature had passed something called the Butler Act, which had made it illegal for any state-supported school to teach the theory of creation. That was a prohibition against teaching of human evolution, not of evolution itself. It prohibited the teaching of evolution that contradicted the story of creation as taught in the Bible. That was basically the language of the Butler Act. Well, the American Civil Liberties Union didn't like this, and they ran an ad in Tennessee newspapers seeing if there could be somebody who would be willing to put up a test case for this. Well, the local town boosters in Dayton, Tennessee said this may be a way to get our sleepy place on the map, so they found their 25-year-old football coach and said, hey, would you be willing to be a test case? We'll make sure you don't spend any time in jail. And he said, sure, why not? He hadn't ever taught evolution, but he had stepped into a biology classroom when the principal, who was the biology teacher, had gotten sick. And it was a review session, and they used the state-approved textbook, Hunter's Civic Biology, which actually gave more ink to how to pack a safe lunch than it did to Darwin. But there was a picture of Darwin in it, and it did say in the book that the Darwin's theories are the things that we base the progress of the world on. That was good enough, so they read out a warrant, and the trial was scheduled. And eventually, the trial ended with the foregone conclusion that Scopes was to be found guilty, and the whole idea was to appeal it up to the Tennessee Supreme Court. Never really happened that the law would be repealed because his conviction was overturned on a technicality. But so much of what we know about the Scopes trial, we don't know because people base what they claim on this little play that was later a Hollywood movie by Lawrence and Lee called Inherit the Wind. And Inherit the Wind is really far more about understanding the prevailing mentality of the 1950s McCarthy era than it is anything about the Scopes trial itself. But too many historians have recommended that Inherit the Wind be shown in high school classes and college classes as a way to learn about the Scopes trial. And at the end of the play and the movie, it makes the figure who looks like William Jennings Bryan, who was the prosecuting attorney and the fundamentalist, makes him look like he was a losing fool. But the fact of the matter is, Scopes' conviction was overturned. The law, the Butler Act, stayed on the books until the 1960s. And what had the Scopes trial shown but that anti-evolution legislation can be held up in a court of law? The result of that was that most of the anti-evolution legislation that was passed in the 1920s, about two-thirds of it, took place after the Scopes trial, and because textbook authors were afraid that if you included evolution in their textbooks, they wouldn't sell, they began to take it out of textbooks, and the result was that the verdict for Scopes was really a victory for the anti-evolution cause. It wasn't until after the Sputnik events in the late 1950s when the American high school curricula began to put new emphasis upon science and began to redo biology textbooks that we saw in the 1960s and 70s, a creation-evolution controversy coming back. And it's not because the anti-evolutionist had been defeated in the Scopes trial, it's because they had won such a resounding victory that the pro-evolution forces kind of quieted down for a couple of decades.
Two final questions for you, Dr. Kaltoff. Do you think that confessional creedal Christians make good historians precisely because of the importance of objective truth and of understanding of the sinful nature of all mankind and really of all historical figures that are studied?
I know very good historians who are not confessional Christians, but I think they're good historians because they uphold those canons that you just pointed out that certainly are consonant with being confessional Christians. So I think if somebody understands confessional Christianity and has a sober and sound understanding of human nature, they have a couple of the prerequisites to become good historians. And those others who are maybe not confessional Christians but are good historians also understand something through their studies, that there has to be a kind of honesty and fidelity to both human limitations and to the objective nature of what texts say.
Finally, then, what advice can you give a Christian student who's sitting in a History 101 class taught by a secular progressive? What would you say to them before they go in there for that semester?
Get ready to think. Use your library and find the resources that can help you complement what you learn in the classroom. Almost all stories, and that's what part of what history is telling stories, are told in a way to make some kind of point. Try to discover what kind of point the professor is making. Is he making a point that helps enlighten your understanding of the past, of human nature? Is he trying to make a point that is more about the present and about political agendas or activism today? Discover those and then ask questions. Ask thoughtful questions that reveal that you're not a kind of student who's trying to be a troublemaker, but that you genuinely want to know. The kind of intellectual humility that shows an eagerness to learn is impressive to any professor, regardless of their political ideology.
Dr. Mark Kaltoff is professor and chairman of the Department of History at Hillsdale College. Dr. Kaltoff, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me, Todd. It's been a delight.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to discuss a glaring omission in a recent New York Times story about the importance of Jerusalem to Christians. The story manages to include the importance of Jerusalem to Muslims because of Muhammad's alleged night flight to Jerusalem, to Jews because of their expectation that Messiah will return to Jerusalem. And it mentions Jesus' life and death in Jerusalem, but fails to mention something else. Terry Mattingly will be our guest to talk about this. And then it's This Week in Pop American Christianity. We'll talk with Pastor Chris Rosebro about twisting the storm stories of Scripture. We'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week as well. Issues Etc. has been brought to you in part today by Doxology, the Lutheran Center for Spiritual Care and Counsel. Doxology offers an innovative program of advanced study retreats where your pastor can be refreshed, renewed, and refocused. Find out more at doxology.us. That's doxology.us. History is important to Christians. All history, our history, is important, if only for the reason that we want to know the truth of what happened. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. the College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.
Does your confessional Lutheran nonprofit or church need a new website? Let WordSites help you for free. WordSites is a volunteer-led group of technology and marketing gurus who have come together to help their fellow Lutherans. With the support of an effective website, you can clearly proclaim Christ and Him crucified to the digital world that we live in. To submit your organization for consideration or to learn more, visit WordSites.org. WordSites, your confessional Lutheran website, reformed.